Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. One of the most important things that has happened in the global interfaith community in recent times is that in September, a Universal Declaration of Human Rights by the world's religions was presented. We are very fortunate today to have one of the architects of this masterpiece of human rights with us today. His name is Professor Brian Leppard. He is a leading expert in the fields of international human rights, comparative, and tax law. He was educated at both Princeton and Yale. At Yale, he was the editor of the Journal of International Law. Professor Leppard has multidisciplinary scholarly and teaching interests in the field of international human rights law, humanitarian intervention, international legal theory, comparative law, including comparative religious law, as well as ethics, tax, and business law. He is the author of 7 books and numerous articles relating to these diverse subject areas. Professor Leppard has spoken on the subjects of international law, human rights, and comparative law at conferences and other gatherings around the world. Currently, he teaches law at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln, and he is very active in the Baha'i faith. We're very pleased to welcome to Common Threads today Professor Brian Leppard. Hello, Brian.
Hello, Fred. It's great to talk with you.
You too. You too. This interview has been a long time coming. I read about the Declaration of Human Rights by the world's religions towards the end of last year, and we've been dying to get you on, but you've been a busy guy, and we're very appreciative that you were able to make time today for us.
Thank you. Well, I'm glad we finally got this worked out.
Yeah.
We have the pleasure of talking today.
So let's start with the history. Where did the Universal Declaration of Human Rights by the World Religions have its inception or conception?
Well, this project began almost 20 years ago, and it was an initiative of a group of professors at McGill University in Montreal, Canada, led by Dr. Arvind Sharma. He is a professor of religion and comparative religion at McGill University, and of course an expert in particular in Hinduism. And so he originated this project with the collaboration of a number of other scholars from many other disciplines, including political science, among others. And actually, there was a conference held to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the adoption by the United Nations General Assembly of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That was held in 1998 in Montreal. So that's where this idea of a declaration that would express a uniquely religious perspective on human rights was first floated. And since then, the Declaration has been really a collaborative effort involving input from scholars around the world, including myself. I was actually brought in later into the project, as well as, of course, thousands of individuals who have attended some major conferences that have discussed this Declaration. And, of course, at the most recent of these conferences, which was held in September 2016 in Montreal, the final text of the Declaration was officially published, and it was officially proclaimed.
So the fact that it took 20 years, that says something right there. Was there a great deal of negotiating? Were there tremendous challenges to make sure that everything that is in the Declaration, and this is a significant document. I mean, it has several articles. How many? I have it in front of me. What is it? It's got 30 articles in it.
Yeah.
It's very, very comprehensive. I can only imagine, being someone who's involved in interfaith as I am, that it's not easy to get people to agree on all of the various issues that we have to deal with in our own religions, and then connect with everybody else. And what might look like a great virtue in one religion, it ain't necessarily so in another. Am I correct?
Yes, you are correct. And in fact, a lot of thought and a discussion went into this Declaration. Even so, of course, we don't have any illusions that every believer will subscribe to every statement in the Declaration. Obviously, even within religious traditions, as you said, there is a great variety of opinion, and we wanted also to respect that variety of opinion. But the idea was to announce some very broad principles on which members of all faiths can agree that derive from the essential teachings of those faiths. And of course, often those teachings are expressed in a foundational scripture. So we know, of course, that in practice, many kinds of divisions have arisen in many religions concerning interpretation of these basic foundational principles. But the principles still are the point of agreement, and our attempt was to draw on those foundational principles, like, for example, the concept of the unity of the human family, which is found in all of the great world religions. It's expressed in different forms, but it is a foundational principle in all of the great faiths. This has direct implications for human rights, and our goal was to try to really explore and flesh out these implications. But that took a lot of work. You're absolutely right. There were many, many days of discussion. I was part of a smaller working group that Dr. Arvin convened that met on a couple of occasions to really sit down with this, as you said, very long document and have intensive discussions about each of the provisions and really try to reflect carefully on how the world religions offer a unique and really constructive contribution to discussion of that and implementation, really, of that particular human right.
So for instance, I'm looking at the preamble. It says, whereas the failure to acknowledge and redress the injustices done to victims of racism, sexism, religious discrimination, nationalism, imperialism, classism, casteism, and any other form of oppression is inimical to the full realization and flourishing of human rights. Of course, that's a wonderful statement. But for instance, sexism. What is sexism to one religion or even one sect or movement of a religion is simply common practice and appropriate in another part, again, of the same religion. So you have a lot of people, a lot of progressive Muslims feel the hijab or the burqa is sexist. And then again, you have a significant amount of Muslims, perhaps the majority, that would say at least the hijab is not sexist. It was declared by God as the appropriate dress for women. And there you have it. So I'm assuming you kept things fluid enough to allow different interpretations of something like sexism.
That's true. That is certainly true. On the other hand, we did believe very strongly that if one looks at the foundational teachings and scriptures of all the world religions, one does find recognition of the inherent equality of the sexes. Granted, over many centuries, if not millennia, practices have been adopted within, or among, I should say, believers in these faiths that may in fact be sexist. The foundational principles really are supportive of equality of women and men. So I will give you a simple example. I actually just taught a course. I teach a course on international perspectives on the U.S. legal system here at the University of Nebraska College of Law. And we introduce all of our students to the major legal systems of the world, including Islamic law. So I had the opportunity to talk about Islamic law in my class on Tuesday. And one of the points I made is that if one looks at the Quran itself, one finds many affirmations of the equality of women and men. In fact, there are many, many verses that refer to women and men equally. It actually uses the phrase men and women alike, men and women alike. There are really only a few verses in the Quran that have been used to justify certain discriminatory practices against women. And this, of course, is a fact pointed out by many Muslim women who are seeking to reform current practices that really do contradict this teaching of equality. One example that I offer is the Quran affirms that women have the right to work and to keep a share of their earnings from working. and they have a right to own property in their own name. Of course, this was a right that women in the West did not enjoy until about 150 years ago. So I think, again, our goal was to look at foundational principles, especially in the revered scriptures of these faiths, even acknowledging that, frankly, many believers contravene these very principles. And there is not going to be agreement on the concrete application of these principles. And, of course, the Declaration itself acknowledges that believers themselves have committed gross violations of human rights and atrocities, including, of course, as we know, acts of terrorism that, quite frankly, are violations of the fundamental tenets of their own faith.
Certainly. And there are those who attempt to disassociate terrorism, particularly if it's from in the Islamic world. They tend to disassociate. They say that's not Islam. These people are masquerading as Muslims. Would you counter that with anything?
Well, without pretending to get inside the head of any particular terrorist or group, I think it is fair to say that, of course, terrible acts have been perpetrated in the name of religion throughout the millennia. This has given religion a very bad name among many people, quite understandably. And I think we have to acknowledge that religion has absolutely been explicitly invoked and perhaps sincerely invoked by the followers of these faiths. Even in European history, we need look no further than the religious wars that really ravaged Europe, and they were wars between Christians. And, of course, the Protestant princes that thought they had the right version of Christianity, and the Catholic princes thought they had the right version of Christianity. No doubt they were very sincere believers, and yet I think objectively we can ask the question, in fighting wars against fellow Christians in the name of Jesus Christ, were they actually implementing the teachings of Jesus? And I think objectively we could probably say, no, they weren't. They may have been sincerely motivated by religious faith, but that doesn't mean, of course, that they were actually practicing the principles of being peacemakers, for example, that Jesus calls upon all of us to be. So I think similarly with the acts of terrorism that are going on today in the name of Islam, I mean, absolutely, they are carried out in the name of Islam. And, for example, ISIS is implementing its version of Islamic law and calls it Islamic law, but objectively we can look at each one of its practices and ask, is this actually consistent with the teachings of the Quran, for example? Of course, we have to recognize, again, there is a distinction between the foundational teachings of faith as reflected in their revered scriptures and the millennia, really, of interpretations and legal regulations that have been added by religious leaders. So, obviously, one can consider those regulations part of the religious legal system, but we can also say that they may be totally inconsistent with the foundational teachings of the founders.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is Professor Brian Leppard. He teaches law at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln, and he is one of the architects of a Universal Declaration of Human Rights by the World Religions, which is what we're talking about today. Brian, I know that as someone who is as active as I am in interfaith circles here in Michigan, that one tends to see that when a circle, a small circle or a large circle of people interested in interfaith convene, they tend to be from the more progressive ends of their chosen religion. And it's interesting because one of the things that we hear at the Interfaith Dialogue Association, people in West Michigan who are interfaith activists, have really tried to do is be more welcoming to those people who are of a more conservative bend, particularly conservative forms of Christianity. And I'm wondering if your fellow architects, the people who were integral in the formation of the Declaration, would you say that you had a pretty fair balance of people you'd consider liberal, conservative, and also people in the middle?
Well, I do believe that there was an effort, of course, to reach out to people of all different viewpoints within these faiths. And frankly, that's one reason you find that the Declaration does try to respect those differences. Some of the language, honestly, was intentionally drafted to leave open the possibility of various interpretations, such as those who might support the death penalty, those who might have particular views on abortion, other issues like that that can often be flashpoints for disagreements. And that does reflect the fact that there were people of diverse viewpoints from within each religion that did participate. And of course, especially in the very large conferences that were held, those did attract a diverse group of believers. Having said that, I think it is fair to say, though, that the Declaration does and was intended to really announce a vision of world religions that is inclusive, that is unifying, that seeks to bring people together and not divide people, and does take a very strong stand against religious practices that seek to divide people and seek to claim exclusive truth for one group as opposed to another, and that justifies oppression of other groups in the name of religion. And in that sense, one could say, yes, it is a document that does take a stand in favor of that understanding, if you will, of the purpose of religion, which is to bring people together and not divide. So I think it's true that some believers will not agree with some of the provisions of the Declaration.
I'm looking at Article 7. All are equal before the law, and everyone has a right to equal protection under the law, without any discrimination on the grounds of race, color, sex, sexual orientation, language, religion, or belief, political or other opinion, national, indigenous, or social origin, caste, class, ownership of property, birth, etc. So, obviously, what sticks out here is sexual orientation. Mm-hmm. Now, you're not saying anything about the theology of sexual orientation. You're not saying whether God approves of someone who might be gay or transgender or anything like that. You're simply saying that you should have equal protection under the law. I'm just
exactly
curious how this was negotiated.
Well, first of all, the Declaration was intended to be a complement to the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and it is intended to supplement that declaration, which was intentionally drafted to not reflect any kind of religious or spiritual vision, except for, of course, the basic vision that we are actually created equal and should treat one another in a spirit of brotherhood, in the words of the UN Universal Declaration. But having said that, our goal was to, in effect, restate the rights in the UN Universal Declaration, including the right to equality under the law, but with a unique perspective that world religions can offer. And I would say that although obviously different religions approach the issue of homosexuality in different ways from a theological standpoint, and certainly regarding standards of conduct, for example, that believers are expected to observe in relation to, well, frankly, all kinds of sexual relations, right? I mean, religions do typically have laws regulating sexual behavior, including among heterosexuals. So the goal, though, was to reaffirm this fundamental principle of equality before the law, which you can find in all of the world's great religious scriptures. And in fact, if you look at the history of law and of international law, some of the earliest expressions of this concept of full equality before the law, regardless of any factor, like wealth or social status or power, one can find in the scriptures, like the Hebrew scriptures, like the Quran. This is a foundational principle that we believe needs to be reinforced, and in particular, discrimination under the law on any ground needs to be affirmed, needs to be prohibited very clearly, and that includes based on any factor, including sexual orientation. So you are correct, though, that of course this leaves open the different theological perspectives on the morality of different kinds of behavior, right? Different kinds of, certainly sexual behavior. But nevertheless, we believed that it is certainly appropriate and important to affirm that legally there should be this equality. Now, we were careful not to address particular issues like marriage, because there can also be differences of opinion among members of religions on that particular subject.
Certainly. Now, this raises a question for me. Article 15, everyone has the right to a nationality. Who is denied a nationality?
Well, actually, there are many people in the world who are literally stateless. And depending on the laws of the country in which they are born, they may not, in fact, have a nationality at birth. Not every state or country recognizes that you earn a nationality simply by being born in that place. And the reality is, too, there are many discriminatory laws, including against women and mothers. And thanks to the application of these laws, some of which can be religiously based, others based on, for example, cultural tradition, tribal law, many individuals can literally be stateless. And this is a huge problem in the world. There is no government that protects them, even in theory. So this is an issue, of course, that's being addressed by the United Nations at a number of levels, but there is a huge problem with so-called stateless persons.
Couldn't you give
so
us
this is
time?
Also a right recognized in the UN Universal Declaration, of course, but it's one that is rampantly violated.
Can you give us an example of a group of people who are suffering with this?
Well, actually, at right now, I would hesitate to do that just because I would want to make sure to be accurate.
Sure, sure.
In my facts, but again, there can be laws, for example, in various African countries that do allow tribal law to govern some issues, including ones of nationality, that may, for example, say that, you know, a child does not automatically have the nationality of that country, that nationality may actually depend on the citizenship of the father but not the mother, and then if the father is not a national of that country, then, in fact, under that country's laws, that child may not have that nationality. Now, I'm happy to give you some more concrete examples in a follow-up conversation.
That's fine.
But yes.
So this also might play into the movement. I think it's gained a bit of traction over the last couple of years to disqualify those people born in the United States under certain circumstances of claiming an American nationality.
Well, that is certainly true. I mean, that would also be a case where someone could be deprived of a nationality if citizenship by reason of birth is not or no longer recognized here. That's true.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't heard anything about that as of recent, but over the past couple of years, we would hear something or read something every now and then. I think that's should be a great concern to all of us.
Absolutely. Yeah.
We're coming down to the wire for the. For the end of this particular program, Brian, but before we go, I want you to tell us, if people are interested in accessing this declaration, where would they go? And aside from the declaration itself, is there anything else that could help people understand it better on the web?
Sure. Well, I would recommend that they visit the website for the most recent conference at which the declaration was unveiled, the third global conference on world's religions after September 11th, and the website for that is www.worldreligions2016.org. So the text can be found there, both in English and French. And actually, the document that you can find there does explain a little bit about the history of it at the end of the document. So that is one place I would recommend. And, you know, I also did deliver some remarks at the unveiling of the declaration last September, and those have been reproduced and are actually published on the website of the University of Nebraska College of Law. So if you, frankly, just visit law.unl.edu and look under effectively press releases, you should be able to find the text of my remarks, which also gives a little bit more of an explanation of the reasoning and thinking behind the declaration.
And do you have a website yourself for the work you do?
I don't, other than my faculty page on the law school's website. So again, you can find that at law.unl.edu and just look for my name, okay. Brian Leppard.
That's how I found you.
If I read out the whole URL, it would probably take up another 5 minutes of your program. Essentially, though, it is law.unl.edu/Brian-D-Leppard.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Not too difficult. Yeah.
Not terribly. No, no.
Right.
Well, Brian, it's been great to have you here. I have many more questions, and we will talk to you next week on these.
Sounds great. Thanks, Fred.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and Professor Brian Leppard has been our guest, and we've been talking about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights by the World's Religions, and we will continue this conversation next week, right here on WGVU.